Student Press Law Center celebrated a very big birthday this fall, turning 40 years old since our founding in 1974. The origin of the Student Press Law Center dates back to a landmark book by the author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jack Nelson, a book called Captive Voices. We'll talk a little bit about Captive Voices and about a modern-day sequel that is set to be released under the auspices of our friends at the Society of Professional Journalists. I'm Frank Lamonti, the Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center, and the SPLC is a nonprofit advocate for the rights of student journalists and their advisors everywhere. You can find out more about our work at www.splc.org, and we hope you'll take advantage of all of the free legal and educational services we offer. Today on the SPLC podcast, we're joined by two eminent journalism educators who are active in the Society of Professional Journalists Journalism Education Committee. That committee decided to undertake a reexamination of the research that Jack Nelson and his committee on the study of scholastic journalism undertook 40 years ago, when after a nationwide tour across the country looking at the state of scholastic journalism, they concluded that censorship was the primary cause of the irrelevance of scholastic journalism and the frustration that young people experienced as participants. Professor Rebecca Talent is here with us from the University of Idaho School of Journalism and Mass Media. Professor Talent has a PhD from Oklahoma State University. Her doctorate is in education. She has a specialty in issues about media ethics, about the Native American press. She's been a widely published writer on the subject of media ethics and has 12 years of professional newspaper experience, including serving as a newspaper ombudsperson. And so we're delighted to have Professor Talent. With us on the podcast is Professor David Burns, who is here in the D.C. area at Salisbury University in Maryland. Professor Burns has his PhD from the University of Maryland, also has a degree from my favorite school, University of Georgia. Professor Burns is Associate Professor of Communication Arts at Salisbury University, and his specialties include electronic journalism and new media production, as well as international reporting. So thank you, Professor Talent, Professor Burns, for being here with us and for this really, really valuable new piece of research. And I guess, Becky Talent, let me throw it to you first, just to kind of explain the book that is coming out. Is called Still Captive: History, Law, and Teaching of High School Journalism. So I guess sort of how did the idea for this project get hatched, and then how did you go about conducting the research?
Well, this was interesting. This started off with a very simple question that came to me as chair of the committee back in 2011, and it was the then National SPJ president, John Enslin, asked, well, what's going on with high school journalism? I keep hearing that schools are closing their journalism programs because people think journalism is dying. I took it back to the committee. We began discussing it. We began researching it a little bit because, you know, we're all college professors. And we came back and we said, well, you know, there's Captive Voices. 20 years later, in 94, there was Death by Cheeseburger. And all of a sudden, we started saying, well, is anybody else going to be doing this, you know, every 20 years to see what's happening now? And there was this, you could hear the crickets. They were just resounding silence. So we began looking first at the idea of how do we figure out, is this notion that journalism is dying really impacting high school journalism? We went through a number of different things trying to figure out how to do it, and finally we said, you know, we need a survey of high school journalism teachers, and we began working with our friends at the Journalism Education Association and began bothering the SPLC and asking questions. And suddenly we found not only that we were doing this survey, but we began breaking up areas and saying, well, we need somebody to write about the law and how the law has changed, and we need somebody to write about how to really teach an effective class, and let's bring in the ideas of how journalism teaches creative and critical thinking, collaboration, the communication, all the things that are core elements that principals say they want, and other things, and all of a sudden we were doing a book.
Right. Well, you went about actually surveying 200 and some odd journalism education members representing quite a diverse array of teachers across the country. And I guess let me ask David Burns, you are co-authors of one of the chapters in this book where you talk about some of the results of this survey research. What to you, I guess, were some of the more important or more eye-opening takeaways from the research?
We asked one open-ended question, and that was, do you have suggestions on how scholastic journalism can be improved? We asked all the respondents that question, and got quite some very, very interesting answers. But I think the thing that sort of came about or came out of this was this idea of they would use terms like they felt like they were feverishly peddling but going nowhere. In the process. And it became quite evident as we looked at these responses versus what was polled 40 years ago and 20 years ago, and it seems like everything's changed and nothing's changed. Although the journalism industry itself and the education systems are very different than they were 20 years ago and 40 years ago, the way journalism is considered, the way it's treated, the way it's supported has changed very little when we talk about high school journalism, high school education.
One of the interesting statistics that I've seen in sort of a preview of the forthcoming book talked about mandatory administrator oversight and review pre-publication, and your statistic was actually remarkably consistent with what the SPLC and our partners at Kent State University have found when we've done some surveying on this of students and journalism advisors, which is about a two-thirds, one-third split, that about one-third of high school journalism programs are under mandatory prior administrative review, and about two-thirds are not. So that was an interesting finding. I guess either of you, I mean, starting with David, was there sort of a takeaway from that? Was that in any way noteworthy or surprising to you?
That came up repeatedly in respondents. In their responses, what they talked about is, for example, more than one-fourth of the people who answered the question said that comprehensive training needed to be done, and they singled out administrators in that list, that, you know, we need to teach administrators about freedom of expression and First Amendment rights and this kind of thing, and the role that it plays and the important role that it plays in high schools, and what kind of information to be taught to students about free expression and about the First Amendment as they work in their media organizations, their student and school function media organizations. So, oh, absolutely, that was a huge response by the participant, that they are being stymied in a lot of ways by the administration, that they're not understood by the administration, that they're not supported by the administration, and sometimes they're punished financially by the administration too.
And it's not just, you know, in terms of the fact that the teachers feel like, you know, they're in the right and they know what they're doing, and that they know that, you know, they have certain rights and responsibilities. One of the things that we found is that a lot of the teachers were feeling overwhelmed because they didn't understand a lot of the background. They didn't understand the laws. They hadn't, in a couple of cases, they'd not even heard of Hazelwood. So, you know, they what amazed us was that nearly one-fourth of all high school journalism teachers that we surveyed have had absolutely no journalism training. They're English teachers, they're librarians, they're historians, and they were offered the chance to either earn more money or they were just simply asked by their school to run their student media. And they absolutely don't know what distinguishes journalism, you know, good journalism, bad journalism. They don't understand that there are, you know, some laws that they need to be taking into consideration and thinking about when they're working with their students. One of the things that really surprised me probably more than anything else was that in addition to the fact that one-fourth of the teachers have had no training, only about 38% have had at least a class in college, but 98% of the teachers say that they only get additional training from attending journalism workshops in the summer when they can find them. And that, to me, was just astounding, especially since colleges and universities seem to be sort of getting rid of those programs because the attendance has been low.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, one of the recommendations that the education committee makes as a result of this research talks about involving colleges, universities, and the journalism profession more actively in supporting journalism programs and journalism advisors in particular. How do you envision that working, I guess, and what are the sorts of support that would be most needed?
Well, David, if I could take it first.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
One of the things that we're talking about quite seriously, a lot of SPJ chapters are already working at looking at their local programs. Where can those professionals go into those classrooms and help out? And I know specifically in places such as New Jersey and Florida, they are being very proactive with some of the chapters. One of the things that came out not very good for colleges and universities where in the question that we asked, 50% of the teachers said they received no support from professionals. 56% of them said they received no support from colleges and universities. Well, that puts the colleges and universities in a bad light, and now some are starting to look around and say, well, how can we cure this, although not as quickly as the professionals? And I think that if we could get the colleges and universities to start looking at bringing back courses in how to teach high school journalism, that would be a huge first step.
David, were you going to add on to this one?
Yeah, I wanted to point out, by the way, that that this has been a this issue of having not having enough support outside the school was reiterated 40 years ago, and it was mentioned 40 years ago. It was reiterated 20 years ago, and we're still seeing it today. That there's people demand, or they would like more connections between public schools, all right? People that are peers, local journalism colleges, absolutely, more business connections, and these kind of things. I think that some journalism professors are actually participating in high school in high school training and so on, sometimes formally. The Maryland Scholastic Press Association, I would go and teach there in the summers. But I, just 2 weeks ago, I was at a high school here talking about media literacy and journalism courses and so on. So maybe informally they do some of this stuff, but I think it needs to be more institutionalized for sure.
Well, one of the, I guess, saddest single statistics that I saw in a summary of the forthcoming book was, and Becky, I think you've actually been quoted addressing this, that more than half of all high school journalism advisors say that they go to work in fear of being disciplined by their supervisors for something that their students publish.
Yes. It's really very sad. There's a... And lately some of the cases that we're hearing don't help that. The Pennsylvania case. I'm going to mispronounce the name of the district.
Right. This is the offensive nickname for the school mascot, right? And the students are embroiled in a still ongoing controversy in which both the student editor and the journalism advisor have suffered discipline simply for enforcing an editorial policy voted on by the student editors that says we will not use this racially offensive term in our pages.
And the principals, I'm sure, around the country hear about that and say, well, you know, we have a right to promote our school the way we want through the student newspaper. Unfortunately, they're seeing the student newspaper as a public relations tool. They're not seeing it as a journalism learning tool and teaching children how to think critically and strategically, how to think about the news and how it impacts people. So I think that is really something. If I could change three things, if I ruled the world and could change three things of the things that we found in the study, that would be one of them, helping to take the fear away from teachers so that they can go out and teach what needs to be taught without worrying about, well, am I going to get into trouble because I told the students it's okay that they want to do a story on X or Y. It's just so important because the students feel that fear. I've taught high school. I know the students feel that fear and understand that I'm scared that I'm going to get my teacher in trouble. We shouldn't live in that kind of society. We should be able to allow the students to go out and be reporters.
This, too, is where I think the profession can help by, when they're aware of these cases, stepping up and going on the record in support of these young journalists and their supervisors. I think that's key. I mean, the more light we can shine on this kind of thing, the better off they're going to be. When I'm confronted with what administrators sometimes see as factual errors or so on, I just tell them, you know, you have a way of voicing those, of stating your facts as you see them, and, you know, go ahead and exercise those. Do you see that makes a heck of a lot more sense? And public relations-wise, it looks better for the institution when you address them in those ways instead of trying to put gags on reporters and gags on newspapers that doesn't serve any purpose whatsoever.
Sure, and of course, although fixing factual errors is often cosmetically the reason that schools claim that they need the authority to pre-approve content, in our experience, it's the very rare person who can resist temptation to do more than that. And certainly when students call the SPLC hotline looking for help from an attorney, it's not because a principal fixed a mistake in their copy. It is because invariably the excuse that students are given over and over again by schools is that you're hurting the image of the school, you're making the school look bad, and you're being a bad citizen of the school by criticizing our policies or portraying us in an unfavorable light, which of course is unteaching good journalism. It is actually affirmatively teaching bad journalism. The rationale given for the censorship authority often diverges from the way that it's actually used in practice. Let me ask, as we're sort of wrapping up, but David, you know, I think, and I should plug the book by name again, Still Captive: History, Law, and the Teaching of High School Journalism. David, now that this research has been gathered and is about to be published, what are you hoping will happen next? What are you hoping that people will do with the benefit of this information?
You know, I think I would like to see journalism become more of a part in high schools again. And one of the things that sort of came up in our survey was that the best and the brightest, let's say, were no longer gravitating towards journalism classes. They were gravitating towards AP classes, and because AP classes help give them college credits and so on, and a journalism program does not fit in. So I guess if I were to, you know, hope and wish for something, it would be that journalism type courses would be recognized as an English class or something like that as part of an AP credit. And I think that would go a long way. I mean, it certainly promotes media literacy. It promotes critical thinking. You know, all of the things that we would like our college students and our graduating high school students to have as skills in their toolboxes. They're only accentuated by going through journalism programs and so on. So I guess what takeaway I would like to see happen, what change I would like to see at an institution, that would be it. I also, as far as just within society, what I would like to see happen is people need to recognize that really in this day and age, today's elementary school students and high school students have never really known a free press in action, a wartime press. That's, you know, it's been hobbled by free press restrictions and so on. And so we need to incubate this free press, free thinking type of person in our society in order for democracy to thrive and democracy to survive. That in and of itself is a real worry for me, is that I see these students without really a history, a personal history, in free press, and I worry about that.
Well, let me leave the last word to Becky Talon. Same question, I guess. What are you hoping to provoke or to prompt by publication of this book? And then do please finish up by telling us where and when people can get their own copy of Still Captive.
What I'm hoping, because, and I think this is just the educator in me, I really hope that high school journalism teachers can get copies of this, read it. It will help their teaching. It will help give them a better understanding of journalism, how they can teach it effectively, give them some great, great things for the classroom, give them some hope that, yes, this stuff is worthy of AP or worthy of being able to shine in a school as opposed to being, you know, pushed back into a dark corner and heavily regulated. Another thing I hope this does is that I hope that administrators can see that journalism is important. It teaches four core concepts, and that they should support it, not just verbally, but they should support it by helping to find ways to fund it better so that the students can have better equipment. Hopefully the pros will come in and colleges and universities will come in also and help with that as well. It is just incredibly important that we foster our best and brightest youngsters who are currently in high school and junior high to come forward and learn what journalism can help them do, not only in high school, even if they don't go into journalism, but, you know, in life, as a lawyer, as a doctor, sure, as a mechanic, whatever it is, as an engineer, whatever it is you go into being, journalism helps. And you can get Still Captive, History, Law, and the Teaching of High School Journalism, starting in January. It will be available through New Forms Press. It will be also available on Amazon. And I believe the price is going to be somewhere between $35 and $50. It will be available both as a soft cover book and as an ebook.
Well, great. Well, Professors David Burns and Rebecca Talat, we are so grateful for you and all of the researchers who've put your time and your talent into the study that's getting ready to be published in January, Still Captive. We hope that anyone who's experiencing a problem with freedom of expression in schools or colleges, especially student journalists and their journalism advisors, will contact the Student Press Law Center through our hotline 703 703- 807-1904 or by email splc@splc.org. We hope you'll check out all of the legal and educational reference materials that are free for your use at splc.org, and that you'll join us each month for a new edition of this podcast. Thanks again to Professor Burns and Professor Talent, and to all of our good friends at the Society of Professional Journalists, and thank you for listening.